your dream girls, boys, we'll make you happy. Yeah, yeah, we're your dream girls, boys, we'll always care. Be your dream girls, dream girls, never leave you. No, no, and all you got to do is dream, baby, we'll be there, yeah.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You were just listening to Dream Girls by The Dreams, the fictional girls group from the 1960s, featuring the real people, Adrienne Warren, who is with me in the studio today. Hi, Adrienne.
Hello.
And Ciesha Mercado and Moya Angela performing Dream Girls in the 2009 CBS Thanksgiving Day Parade. And here you are now. Yeah. Thanks for being with us.
Of course. Thank you.
Also in the studio with us today, Chester Gregory. He plays the role of rock and roll soul sensation James Thunder Early from the national tour of Dream Girls, and
yes,
which is in Columbus right now. Thanks for being with us today, Chester.
Yes, yes. Thanks for having me.
Also, Detroit News music critic and the author of Women of Motown, Susan Whitehall, has joined us from her office in Detroit. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Ann.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Adrienne and Chester, you were probably very young. Chester, maybe not so much young, but Adrienne, yes, you were very young, if not even born yet, when the 1981 Broadway play came out. And I was just wondering, did you grow up with this story as sort of a totem for the historical journey of the girl groups and the pop music scene of the 1960s? Because I did not. I was really there.
Wow.
I didn't have it explained to me, so...
I did not grow up with it. I was, of course, aware of the original production with Jennifer Holliday, but I hadn't seen it until much later. But I have spent the majority of my career sort of paying tribute to the music from the Motown era. So I'm very aware of, a lot of girl groups and stuff like that. And of course, Frankie Lyman, just groups from that whole era. I've sort of feel like I live there a little bit because I've done so much material from that.
What about you, Adrienne?
I definitely didn't grow up with it, but my parents kept me. I learned a lot about rock and roll, a lot about soul at a very young age. I wasn't really introduced into Dream Girls until a little bit later in my life, and then I actually had a chance to do a 25th anniversary performance with Jennifer Holliday playing Effie when I was 19. So I learned a lot then, and so now it's just great to be a part of this whole new thing, and I'm learning a lot still.
You know, Susan Whitehall from the Detroit News, the fictional 1960s girl group depicted in Dream Girls is sometimes criticized because it unfairly depicts Motown of the 1960s as some sort of dog-eat-dog, backbiting place to be.
Oh, that's not the music business at all.
That's just people.
I'm not sure that's the objection so much because every record company has, dog-eat-dog, backbiting.
Okay.
But I think it's more that people take it to be, a lot of people, the actual story of Motown, when in fact it was, it's inspired by it. It's fictionalized.
Right.
Right.
And I think, especially with the Supremes, I think a lot of people have taken it to heart that Diana Ross didn't deserve to be the lead singer, things like that. And it should have been Florence Ballard. Mm-hmm. It makes a great operatic type story. But, I would argue, and many do, that no, Diana Ross was actually the right person to be the lead singer.
Well, if you listen closely to the storyline, too, it's a very pragmatic approach to putting a group together that's going to be commercially successful.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
It's commercially successful, but, people have actually gone so far as to say she can't sing, and she can. You can look at the YouTube clips. Luckily, in today's age, we have that, and there are many, many clips where Diana is singing live, and the girls are singing live behind her. And unlike today, when you've got auto-tune, she's singing by herself.
Tell it like it is.
She's singing in tune.
Adrienne and Chester, how much did you listen to the Supremes, however, and all the girl groups to prepare for your roles? Adrienne?
I did a little bit, but I didn't too much because this show was loosely based off of the Supremes.
Right.
And our director made a point to let us know that it's loosely based off, so don't study it so much. I'm Saisha Mercado is not Diana Ross, and, mm-hmm. and the story is, it did not happen just like that. I mean, it's more of a story about what happened in the music industry during the 60s and 70s, as opposed to, you know, just about the Supremes. And so I listened to it a little bit, but I listened to more groups than just the Supremes and Marvelettes. I mean, there's so many girl groups during that time that were going through the exact same thing. So it's not just one particular group.
Right, because your genesis as the fictional girls group was much more like the Marvelettes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly, exactly.
And what about you, Chester? Adrian plays Laurel Robinson, sort of the little sister of the group.
Yeah.
You're playing her, the man she has an affair with for several years.
My lover.
Jimmy Early.
Jimmy Thunder Early.
Yeah.
How did you, you know, for the obvious reasons, James Brown comes to mind, but I suppose they might have said, don't be too studied about that as well?
Well, they weren't concerned about that with me because I've done a lot of shows from that era. I would say I've done about 10 years of musical theater dealing solely with that era. So shows like about the doo-wop era, Chicago's Golden Soul, shows about the Motown era. I also portrayed Jackie Wilson in a Jackie Wilson story for 3 years, which ran at the started in Chicago. And then ran it in New York
Apollo.
As well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so with me, it was about, you know, I know that a lot of people who portrayed this role before have mostly based him on James Brown. And so what I wanted to do was just add other elements of those other iconic figures who crossed over for that time, too. So it was not only James Brown, but it was also Jackie Wilson. Mm-hmm. It was also Otis Redding. Mm-hmm. And it was also Little Richard. So yeah. I just threw a little bit of all that in there. Mine is sort of a gumbo. And I watched Diana Ross and Supremes a little bit, too. And ironically, what I found is how heavily she influenced Michael Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
And so it really didn't hit me until I would say about 6 or 7 months ago. I was in a restaurant called Leona's in Chicago, and they play all these old clips. And Diana Ross and Supremes came out. And they were just, like, standing outside their hotel window, and they were lip-syncing. And people were going crazy. Like, you know, in that day and age, they didn't have auto-tune. But what they did, if the people were not in good voice, they just lip-sync.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And they literally had just the 45 playing, just lip-syncing. People were screaming. And for the first time, I really saw the connection between Diana Ross and Michael Jackson, like how much he emulated her throughout his entire career. And, you know, her and, you know, Jackie Wilson and also James Brown, because even the way Michael Jackson did his turns and stuff like that is always right over left, always, his entire career. And that was from Jackie Wilson. Jackie Wilson always did his turns right over left. So, I've been.
I was looking at a Motown reunion clip on iTunes the other day, and Diana Ross is there, and she's bringing the two Supremes back on with her, and then all these other people from Motown and mm-hmm. Barry Gordon and so forth. And what struck me was the connection between Michael Jackson and her as well.
Absolutely.
I saw that. I know what you're talking about just because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was so much younger, but and maybe a little more less artifice. And so much more of a reflection that way. Susan, Motown celebrated its 50th anniversary last year. I was fascinated by the idea after I read about it, how Barry Gordon compared making his groups with making cars at the Lincoln Mercury. I mean, really, when I thought about it, I thought, yeah, there was a sort of
a formula.
Well, and a formula, not in a bad way necessarily,
right.
Because when you have when you have components that are as high quality as he had, for instance, with the Funk Brothers being the Motown backing band, mm-hmm. you couldn't get a better backing band than that. These
right.
guys came out of the jazz scene locally here and were just top players. You usually don't get players that good on a pop record. You mm-hmm. get these guys in the background. You get the songwriting teams, which were stellar. Holland Dozier Holland, you know, mm-hmm. Norman Whitfield. And everybody had their job. So the way he patterned it on the lines that Henry Ford developed was that everybody had their specific task. And so if you were a singer, you wouldn't necessarily, if you brought a song in, unless you were a Smokey or a Stevie, you'd probably be shot down, you know. That wasn't
right.
your job.
Right.
So that it made it very efficient that way.
Yeah.
So it's more like they were making high quality vehicles. They were making Cadillacs, but they weren't making little ones.
Right.
Right. It was interesting. You know, the wigs sort of the whole culture of the wigs sort of was a symbol of that for me a little bit in the show last night too, when you talked about the wigs and that sort of thing. Now, does it make it easier to do a show like that when you do everything in wigs like that?
We have a lot of wigs.
No kidding.
So I have about 16 in the entire show. And so, I mean, yes, it does in a way because it kind of puts you in that era. It helps me because I'm so young and I wasn't there. And I can only just read books and listen to my parents and things like that. So it does. It does help. But at the same time, you're making a product, when you are trying to put a girl group together, you want people to buy the music. You want people to want to be a part of your group and feel like they, like it's a household name almost. So I understand how it being compared to a car, how that could work. And I guess with the wigs as well, because you want us to look a certain way, even with the costumes and everything that we wear, it's all about being a product and all about, being out there for commercial, so.
You know, about the wigs, the girls have always told me, and I call them girls because, they were girls back then.
Yeah.
And we still feel like, I still see Mary and a lot, and I think she'll always be, we'll always be girls to each other. But they've always told me, though, that the genesis of the wigs was so much that they were on those early bus tours. And for the guys, it was simple. You'd get up, you'd go have a shower. But for the girls, hair is really a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a way for them to sleep all night on the bus, whether it was the Dick Clark bus or the Motown Review bus, and, go to the gig and actually look presentable.
Right.
Some of those beehives, too. Did that sort of start out with the girl groups in Motown? Is that where the beehive came from?
No.
Okay.
That was
I knew other people. It was a style, too, but my gosh. They were gorgeous. We're going to have to take a quick break right now. My guests today, Chester Gregory and Adrian Warren from the cast of The Dreamgirls. It's at the Palace Theater right now. And also Susan Whitehall, Detroit News music critic. Give us a call if you have a question or comment. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tell us about your memories from the 60s.
On the next Fresh Air, creating a 3D world in outer space, we talk with James Cameron about writing and directing Avatar, which is nominated for 9 Academy Awards, including Best Director. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 31 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:19. Cloudy skies today with a chance of some freezing drizzle and a little bit of snow flurries throughout the day and a high of 35. Some clouds tonight and a low of 22 degrees. Sunshine for Friday and a high of 35 degrees. Looking ahead to Saturday, cloudy skies with a slight chance of a little snow in the afternoon and a high of 35 for Saturday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I have no doubt that I could love you forever. The only trouble is I really don't have the time. I've got one night only, that's all I have to spare. One night only, let's not pretend.
You are listening to One Night Only from the musical Dreamgirls. With me in the studio today, Chester Gregory and Adrian Warren from the cast of Dreamgirls, the national show that is in Columbus right now at the Palace Theater, and also Susan Whitehall from the Detroit News. She is a music critic and author of The Women of Motown. Why did you say Women of Motown in your title for that, Susan? I was wondering.
Well, I think that it would make sense to say Girls of Motown at this point. And, because it was also not just about girl groups, but I had other women that I profiled. Originally, I had Janie Bradford profiled, for instance, and she was a staffer, a songwriter. Even though that didn't make it into the final book. But I also had Mabel John and others who definitely were not girls. definitely were very womanly.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes very talented, but didn't fit the
the mold. Like Mabel John really came to fame more at Stax Records later. She was an assistant to Berry Gordy and also was recorded early on at Motown. But she didn't have that young teenage kind of girl group thing. She was more of a blues singer. And so very much like in Dreamgirls, the way Effie is portrayed. And so she was really made for Stax Records and did well there.
You know, crossing the color line on the charts back then, that was a very palpable thing. That was a measurable goal.
It was huge.
Yeah, huge. And Chester, your character Jimmy struggled with that. Kind of like a personality, like a split personality kind of thing. There's that scene on stage where he's performing in the theater in Miami, and it's like a split personality.
Yeah.
You know, he could have done that easily, but the artist in him rebelled. How do you identify with that sort of back and forth feeling?
Well, I'm also a soul singer myself and a songwriter, so the lyrics of the show and the way they approach songwriting is very poignant to me even now. I've struggled with that as well, as, you know, not wanting to compromise the artistry, but also wanting to write songs and have music that is transcending, that reaches people. And, I keep going back to Michael Jackson, maybe because I'm from Gary, Indiana. I don't know.
Okay.
But, I have a son, and my son is sort of like my A&R for music, and it never fails. Like something that's just like a great hit, like a great song. He wouldn't know the difference from something that's not a good song or something that is great. And I would play him a song, and without fail, you know, just something from the Motown era or something from Michael Jackson, he would respond to, like, oh, my God, this is great, you know, and then I put on something, you know, mediocre. And that's exactly how he responds. So, but getting back to the story about Jimmy Early, he is he knows that he needs something to help him cross over. And so, you know, but he just doesn't want to go as far as it takes, or, you know, realizes, you know, how uncomfortable it is. So I think it is a constant battle for artists between, you know, the artistry and the integrity and then finding something. I think that's why artists of the Motown era are so great, because they found the medium with that. They found, you know, with the funk band, you know, those guys could play anything, but they went back to the simplicity of the music, finding the groove, finding the soul of the music to really transcend and reach everybody, reach musicians, reach songwriters, reach all these artists, and reach the average listener. It really takes a lot of thought. I work with the songwriter now. We call it deceptively simple.
Mm-hmm.
So that, it seems very simple, but it's a lot of thought and work and, you know, that's involved in it.
Hand in hand with what you're saying, the Motown style of guitars is always like that. There would be two or three or even four guitars on a track, but they're each doing such a simple little thing.
Yeah.
They don't get in each other's way, and it's perfect.
Yeah, it is. It's perfect.
That's why it's so timeless. That's why so many kids, you know, that's why I always knew a lot of Motown songs, and it's not because I heard them over and over again. I needed to hear them, like, twice, and I knew the riff, and I knew exactly, you know, what it was.
They were memorable.
Yeah, it's very memorable.
They were memorable. Is there anything else that explains the longevity, probably the, you know, the universal longevity of the music, Susan?
Well, and I think, you know, kind of dovetailing with what we're talking about, I think Motown sometimes gets slammed for being too slick, for being too crossover. People say that, you know, Stax kind of soul is more authentic, and yet what they're not taking into consideration is that it's in Detroit, jazz was the thing. This is a big jazz scene, and therefore that's part of the deal here. That's the local flavor. That's why Motown had that, what some people would call slickness, what we call sophistication. And I really think, even though it's simple, I think the sophisticated arrangements, that's why it holds up, that it's something you can listen to as an adult and go, wow, that's really cool there.
Yeah.
Like James Jamerson, the great bass player, you could just, you know, listen to his bass tracks all day long.
Yeah.
If you would like to have a comment or would have a question for our guest today, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email now from Barb, an admirer, I might add. She writes, way to go in talking about this classic Broadway show. I saw it last night and was wowed by the production. How was Effie able to hit those notes like Jennifer Holliday? Night after night, amazing. Jennifer Holliday played Effie, of course, in the original Broadway show. Let's hear from that now.
And I am telling you,
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That was Jennifer Holliday singing, and I am telling you, I'm not going at the Tony Awards in 1982. Mm. And just listening to it, it gives me chills.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. Amazing music. How did Susan, the music from the show, differ maybe from the music of the time? Is there anything that you noticed?
It differed very much so, because it's you know, Broadway. It's meant to be a musical, and it's very different from classic Motown or classic soul of the time. It's much more dramatic, much more, it's to bring, you know, take the, you know, the story along.
And, yes.
That's why I'll be curious to see. I know Hal and Dozier Holland have been working on a Broadway musical, and Berry Gordy supposedly is working on his own as well. Hmm. How that would translate, whether you would do the jukebox thing where you have the actual music from Motown, that's what Berry wants to do. But Broadway music is very different from Motown.
It was a great operatic sort of experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
it's very
just singing your way through the
song.
Singing your way, you know, you
there's
sing.
The chorus, the
yeah, and you,
let's
argument
fight and sing about it.
Yeah, we're gonna argument. Oh, we're gonna sing about it. Over makeup, we're gonna sing about it.
Yeah. Let's hear a little bit from the classics right now. How about playing Mr. Postman by the Marvelettes from 1961. I don't know if she... Okay, she put her finger in the air saying, I'm getting there. All right.
Well, she asked how Maya Angelou was able to hit those notes every night, the email.
Yeah, well, let's hear from the Marvelettes now.
Okay. And then we're going to go back to
you. Yeah. Okay, that was the Marvelettes singing Mr. Postman from 1961.
Very
different from the last song we just heard.
Very different.
Yeah.
The emailer asked about how she could hit those high notes. I guess I thought it was sort of a rhetorical question, but how do you hit high notes like that night after night after night?
Well, Maya Angelou has been classically trained as a singer. So, you know, though she's putting all of her heart and soul into it every night, she's also pacing herself so that she's able to do this again tonight and, you know, again, you know, twice on Saturday and, you know, twice on Sunday.
Five times on the weekend.
Yeah.
Well, and all of the rest of you, too.
Yeah,
I mean, but
yeah,
hers
definitely.
Obviously is the different demanding kind of a role. But how do you sustain that night after night?
We just have to pace ourselves.
Pace yourself.
You see, I have my smart water right now that I'm drinking.
Yeah.
You know, warm tea. Everybody has their own separate ritual. You know, some people like cool rooms. I like warm rooms.
Really warm rooms.
I keep my room.
He always comes
80.
In my room and he's like, oh, it's too cold in here.
Yeah. 80 degrees. That's my regimen.
Wow.
80 degrees, lots of smart water, Gatorade, and, you know, just pacing myself.
That's the way Aretha is, too. It's got to be warm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Regarding the music from the Marvelettes, you kind of start out, Adrian, singing that at the beginning of the show, that sort of a thing. What was it like to, I don't know, I want to use the word mimic, but to pattern yourself after that? Because there's the whole body movement thing, and then there's the clipped singing.
It was actually a lot of fun. I mean, just listening to that clip, it made me smile, and that's kind of how I feel in the beginning of the show. And I actually say we're going to be like the Marvelettes in the beginning. That's actually one of my lines. And it's just fun. I mean, it's fun. It's just how it sounds, you know, and listening to that makes you want to smile, makes you want to dance and jig along, and that's how it makes you feel performing it as well. So,
say, Susan, when the women of Motown, when you interviewed them and talked with them, they look back at those days as a lot of hard work or just a lot of fun or both?
A little of both.
Yeah.
I mean, it was such a fun sound, the girl group sound, that early 1961 thing. It was, you know, it was so happy. It was just a giddy kind of sound, because they were teenage girls.
Girls, right.
And they actually co-wrote that song. So that was a genuine teenage message that they were putting out there, and you could tell. There was a little musical here in Detroit about the Marvelette story, and it's quite a dramatic story in its own right. I mean, that early days, they really struggled more than any other girl group did, and they were the first ones to really hit at Motown, the first number one hit that Motown had. Hmm. And yet they didn't really get the benefit of the star build-up and the wardrobe that the Supremes got later. Mm-hmm. They had more of the dresses bought off the rack, you know, in a discount store. And they had to make up their own moves. You can tell from those early YouTubes. They're doing some goofy little dance-ups because they did that. It was before Charlie Atkins was working for Motown.
Well, you can see even the evolution of the moves in the show as well.
Yeah.
They start out kind of jerky and very, but it looked like fun.
Yeah. I think it's probably my favorite part of the show because I can not really worry about being perfect or being really, really polished, but it's just about the music and just going out there and enjoying ourselves, and I think the audience really gets that.
Is there a strong element to that in the early Supremes, or were they always a little bit more sophisticated from the beginning, Susan?
They were always more sophisticated because mm-hmm. by the time they did come along, and they had so many attempts at hits, by the time they did hit, they were the Motown machine was pretty much well in motion, and Charlie Atkins was choreographing every move. So when you see them on Ed Sullivan on these YouTube clips or any other appearances, sometimes they're singing live, but every arm movement is choreographed. And Charlie was very specific, especially about the females, that they never make an awkward move. I mean, he would have a different approach to the Temptations and all, but with the girls, he was very specific about certain movements not being ladylike, and so you just see everything being very choreographed and smooth.
And that's exactly what our director wanted to do with us, because you notice in the show, as soon as we actually do get the record deal, we are very polished from then on. Every hand is the same length, same direction. And I think our director really wanted to show the difference in us just, you know, choreographing ourselves and just being straight from Chicago off the bus, not really knowing much about it, but just enjoying ourselves, as opposed to it being a business now and being polished and being a product. So, yeah, I definitely understand that.
Let's hear from the Supremes. They played live on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964. Was that their first time, Susan, in 1964?
64, yeah. That would be, because that's when they got their string of number one hits, which is amazing, like something like 8 to 10.
Okay, we're gonna listen to Come See About Me. Welcome back. I love these shows. I love listening to all this music. This is so much fun.
Yeah.
That was Come See About Me by the Supremes in 1964, their first time live on the Ed Sullivan Show. How many times were they on the Ed Sullivan Show, Susan? Do you know?
I don't know exactly. I know that statistic is out there somewhere, but it was a lot. I was a little girl, preteen, and that was a highlight of every Sunday night.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and we all swooned over the dresses. The hair, I didn't really realize was wig, but I still, you know, and I teased Mary Wilson about that now, but it was a very profound thing for so many of us that we were, you know, girls who were, we had African-American idols now, and I couldn't look like that, but I wanted to, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very profound thing in the culture of the 60s.
Yeah.
It was profound for young black girls to have those idols now,
yeah.
But also for young white girls.
Mm-hmm.
And we would look at them and go, wow, I want to look like that. Look at that dress, you know.
Oh, yeah, it was awesome. I mean, I grew up the same
thing.
That
would have been fun in the 60s, telling your parents you want to look like a black girl on TV.
Yeah.
Well, that was, and in fact, Susan, that was the conflict that Ed Sullivan had. He was really broke through some racial barriers, having a lot of different people. And I had a fellow, he did a biography of the show, the Ed Sullivan Show, Gerald Nachman, on a month or so ago. And he mentioned the Supremes as one of the most popular acts ever on the Ed Sullivan Show, and he was very committed to breaking those barriers down.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, and about parents not wanting your daughters to look like that. It's actually they're very ladylike, so that there were much worse things that your daughter could emulate. You know, I think my parents would probably rather me emulate them than Grace Slick or. Yeah,
right. It was the 60s. That's right. Yeah. there were other options out there, weren't there?
Yeah.
My producer said Tyler said they performed 14 times on Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oof. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was just a huge star-making vehicle. If you got on Ed Sullivan,
you were it.
And they were perfect for Ed Sullivan because they looked so good and they, you know, smooth and choreographed. And
yeah. Jackie Wilson also has an iconic performance on the Ed Sullivan Show as well.
Was he naughty? Or was
he just had a great performance.
Yeah,
there. Yeah.
Was
he naughty?
Well, there were some on Ed Sullivan, you know, they would only show him from the neck up, you know, so.
All right, Jackie, there's a couple of good clips of him from the Dick Clark Show as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Dick Clark, big supporter.
Yes, and the Motown acts had a lot of support from him, and they went on those tours, the bus tours. And then they patterned their own Motortown Revue after that. They would go on their own Motown Revue shows.
Yeah, and also Berry Gordy wrote a few of Jackie Wilson's first hits.
Well, that's how he got started, yeah. Yep. Reap and Feed and...
To Be Loved.
Lonely Teardrop.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he started Motown, because he wasn't getting paid for those.
Right, exactly.
He figured he'd have his own record company, he'd be paid.
Right. The writer they credited was Jackie Wilson's manager's son, who wasn't even born yet.
That's funny.
That's the way they rolled back then.
Yeah, definitely.
We have to take another quick break, and we'll be back in a few minutes on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, the White House offers billions to help build America's first new nuclear power plant in 3 decades and revive the industry. We'll look at the pros, the cons, and the politics. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point will be here later this afternoon at 1 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Be sure to catch ArtZine, Columbus's monthly art show, anytime online at wosu.org/artzine. On this month's show, see an exclusive interview with pianist Andre Watts and his work with the Columbus Symphony Orchestra, and go behind the scenes of a new exhibit at the OSU Urban Art Space, showcasing 50 of the most intricate and colorful penny scales. ArtZine gives you a firsthand look at the arts in action in Columbus. Online at wosu.org/artzine. 31 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today, and a chance of a little freezing drizzle and a few snow flurries. A high of 35 this afternoon. Clouds tonight and a low of 22 degrees. Some sunshine for Friday and a high of 35. Looking ahead to Saturday, clouds and a slight chance of afternoon snow and a high of 35. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back. You were just listening to You Keep Me Hanging On by The Supremes from 1966. Joining me in the studio today to talk about the change since the 1960s and the Motown movement, Dreamgirls cast members Chester Gregory. He plays the rock and roll and soul sensation James Thunder Early in the show, and also Adrian Warren, who plays Laurel Robinson, the youngest of the Dreams. James sort of represented the old ways, and Adrian, your character embraced the new very quickly, and yet they fall in love. How did that? I know it's very sweet and kind of a subplot. Obviously a subplot, but interesting in and of itself. How did that feel for you in terms of interpreting that dichotomy? Really,
Well, I mean, it's common of that day and era for, you know, these tours and, you know, these with these artists.
Well, the affair
like
itself.
Yeah, exactly. But in musical theater, you have, you know, so little time. So, so that's why oftentimes, you know, that first sight is like love at first sight. So with me, what I do is I interpret it as like as soon as he sees her, it's just like pow, like love at first sight. Just to give it another layer as opposed to, you know, just a teenager he's trying to hook up with.
Right.
You know, because they do stay together for like 7 years or more. Yeah.
I think for Laurel, he starts off as a kind of like a Michael Jackson would be for me. It's just like an idol, as you know, a pop's rock soul star that I liked, and I've had posters up on my walls and things like that. And so, of course, anybody want to date that person? And when she gets the chance to actually sing backup for him, I think she learns a lot about the business and she's kind of attracted to his talent as well as everything that she can learn from him in the music industry before she kind of goes off with the dreams and moves on to the new era of where music is going. So, that's
that point of his breakdown. And of course, he dies from a heroin overdose.
In the film, right.
Very Hollywood of them to do that.
Yes.
In the stage production, they were really, really, they really did not want to show that. So like, because in the stage production, he doesn't die. He just kind of falls off the planet somewhere.
Yeah. Well, he disappears.
And it's sort of assumed that he has a heroin overdose because of the film now, the original intention of Dreamgirls, particularly with James Thunder Early, was to not focus on like drugs and alcohol abuse. But just to really focus on the business and how the business changes people. Actually, in the original production, they had this line to just repeat it over. Showbiz, just showbiz, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that through line is still in there. And, you know, though when he dies or disappears or whatever, sort of, you know, heroin overdose, which was very, you know, very real for that day and age, too, for, you know, singers to have, you know, to abuse drugs and alcohol.
It was, although I don't see that being the case at Motown in that era.
Right, exactly.
Later on, sure, in the 80s, but...
Right.
In the 60s, that was more the other record companies or scenes.
You know, we're talking about that it's more about the business of, and it sort of... When you look at someone like Barry Gordon and the character that's depicted loosely based on him in the movie Dreamgirls, it talks really mostly about building that most successful independent record country and record company in history, which is what Barry Gordon did. It's amazing on any level, and also the most successful African American owned business in America. It's kind of an amazing thing.
It is, although if you Barry Gordy is such an amazing guy that if you talk to him for any length of time, it's like I wrote one time in one of my interviews with him that, you know, if you're in the room with him, you are his employee. You know, he manages to kind of draw you in and convince you that you're on the same team and you're working with him. And, you know, he's very inspirational in that way. I can see how even today his former Motown stars still act like he's the boss. Whenever every year they have a Motown gala here in Detroit in November, and a lot of the old stars are here, a lot of the veterans, and no matter what happened in the past, even if they had issues getting their money, whatever, it all melts away and they go up on stage and he directs them and tells, okay, you sing now. Okay, you sing. No, no, you be quiet.
Wow. Do you attend that every year?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
It's a big fundraiser here for the Motown Museum, and it's just stunning. You know, you've got Stevie, you got Smokey, you got all of them.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend for anyone to get out and see the Motown Museum. When we were there with the Jackie Wilson story, we went through the Motown Museum, and just to see where all of those hit songs were made, it's just...
Yeah, this just little house.
The history is so rich, you can almost feel the presence of the greats still there as you walk through that museum.
Yeah, and when the studio is still there and still intact in the back, and the Funk Brothers will say this, and you can feel it. You can feel the music that was made there.
Yeah. Definitely.
It's vibrations. It's all physics. Hey, sorry about misnaming Barry Gordy, of course. I was saying Barry Gordon. I'm sorry. It's a slip of the tongue. I realized it. And then, of course, sort of my intrepid producer. I was wondering about the Diana Ross and the Supremes and how they eventually eclipsed so many amazingly talented people, Susan. What what went by the wayside because of that? They were too big. The world wasn't big enough for all of them.
Yeah, in a way. I know they say at the time that the way the business was that you couldn't release too many girl groups records at once, for example.
Yeah.
They didn't want to overwhelm the market. They didn't think radio would play that, you know, two or three different girl group songs at once. But also HDH, Holland Dozier Holland, were in such a hit-making mode. They were writing songs that were perfect for them, and they were on a roll. But, you know, Smokey was still, he was still writing great songs for the Marvelettes in the 60s, more of a jazzy mode. And they were doing okay. So Martha Reeves was doing okay.
Yeah.
But you still sense the resentment a little bit that the Supremes were getting the A-team. They were getting the best clothing, the best everything. Sure, they were, yeah.
Wow, the clothes. Are they? Wow, those dresses. I mean, you actually get to wear them, Adrienne.
Yeah, I do.
What do they feel like on?
They're very beautiful to look at. They're not, sometimes they're not the best things to perform in. I mean, they're not the most comfortable things. But, I mean, it's back to your product. And they're very heavy. And we do
with the sequins, especially,
very heavy, and sometimes I actually used to get bruises on my shoulders from my dress being so heavy on my shoulders. And you know, they're actually the Supremes, like Diana Ross, is tiny, and those dresses are so heavy on your body, and you're trying to do all these dance moves while you're singing. It's a lot to deal with, and try not to trip over your dress. It's a lot, but you just smile through it and keep going.
I don't know if you guys have seen this, but Mary Wilson has an exhibit of Supremes dresses. It's been at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's been here in Detroit at the Detroit Historical Museum. And, you know, some of the stuff about Florence Ballard allegedly being so big, she really wasn't.
Right. Just relatively.
But big in that
relative to Diana, anyone looks huge.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you see the three dresses side by side in that exhibit, you realize, you know, Diana was about the equivalent of a size zero today.
Yeah.
Mary may be a two, and Florence was really an eight.
I'd be lucky to be a Florence, in other words. The dresses, how important were those clothes to their success, Susan?
Oh, it was huge because, again, you know, you had girls like me just, you know, loving the music, but also the image was so key, and that put them over, you know, to a teenage market. That's really important. It was important. And plus, Barry Gordy wanted his acts to be able to go anywhere to play a high-class nightclub. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the game. That was part of looking good. And Diana Ross was very interested in fashion from the get-go, from the jump. When she was a high school girl here in Detroit, she went to Cass Tech, which was a very elite high school. Mm-hmm. You had to test to get into it. And she was very making her own clothes, very into, you know, sewing. She was into sports as well, very smart. Hmm. But she was always interested in fashion and even wanted to go into that, maybe.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, she must have had a big hand in the Mahogany movie then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was tailor-made for her. A movie about fashion. Oh, my gosh. She had the figure of a model. I know her daughter has said, her daughter, the actress, that she's got a lot of her mother's clothing from that era, and she wears it.
Wow.
Wow. Those are museum pieces. Say, I would be remiss in Columbus to not mention that there's relatives of the man who wrote the lyrics in the book for the Broadway show, Tom Ion. He is deceased now. Mm-hmm. But a friend of mine that went to the show with me last night knows his nephew. And he has several, I think, nephews and nieces in Columbus. And just a shout out to them.
Hi.
Hey.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. A little Columbus connection there. Will this go on forever, Susan? Will this always be a benchmark? Or I guess maybe a better question is, where do you see the influence in today's music now?
Well, you see it in American Idol to sit Motown songs. I mean, they had Motown Week last year. You see, it's easy to interpret a lot of those songs and put your own spin on them, especially something like that where you've got singers who don't write their own material. A lot of this material still holds up mm-hmm. to interpret. So I don't think that's ever going to go away. Right now, music is in a place where it's not really about melody, so it's hard to say if it'll swing back.
Everything always seems to, though.
Yeah.
If you'd like to speak with the performers from Dreamgirls or Susan Whitehall from the Detroit News, music critic, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Diana Ross and the Supremes were obviously, you know, an inspiration, at least, for the larger groups. Did you identify with that, with what they were, who they were, Adrian?
Yeah.
You're young.
Yeah,
so.
I am. Yes, I do, in a way, because I think, and just being a girl group, they just did, I mean, all the girl groups, they were exactly the same. It just happened that the Supremes, like you said, they got the A-team and they got the better dresses and they got everything else. So I identify with them in that way as, you know, and I'm actually a singer on my own. And so I understand what it's like to try to get in the music industry and to try to be molded a certain way and to be able to say, no, I don't want to be that way, but I want to stay true to my artistry. So I do, but then again, it's a little different for me because I didn't grow up, you know, in the Motown era. I can only read and learn about it and research it. So it's a little different for me.
What about Diana Ross breaking away from the Supremes? Susan, how big of a deal was that?
Oh, it was a huge deal. I think.
I mean, I know it was to us as consumers of it, but,
you know, today it would have been done differently. You can have an artist go off and do things on their own and come back to the group. But at the time, it was sort of on proven ground, and could the Supremes still go on without her? And they did, but it's a totally different. The 70s Supremes sound different.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say. It, you know, she had to do it, and she just was into the movie career at the time as well, so it was inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the funny stories, though, that I recalled in my book about Diana, I think Diana gets demonized way too much. But clearly she was very, very, ambitious.
Yeah.
And some of the stories, like Martha Reeves tells one about getting this cool new outfit when they were out on the road. And before she knew it, Diana had gotten the same outfit. Because the Supremes opened the show, she was wearing it first. Martha called home and called Mr. Gordy, and it was like, do you know what Jade is?
Oh, wow.
So there was a lot of that stuff going on, a lot of vying for a position.
Well, even on the posters.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah.
That was they started to notice where the names went, how big the point was on the print and so forth. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you have a question. And Bob, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Just wanted to say thank you for the show, and you do a phenomenal job. I'm from back east, and I listen to you when I come out here.
Thanks, Bob.
You're very welcome. Absolutely, and to the cast of Dreamgirls, keep up the great work. Keep it going. I wanted to ask the researcher from Detroit, what's Diana Ross doing now? I know that I didn't buy it, but I liked what I had heard on her last CD. Is she still working, or where is she at?
Yeah, that last CD was pretty good, you know.
I thought so too. Yeah, absolutely.
It really didn't get as much attention as it should have.
Unreal, yeah.
She's done live dates. She hasn't done a lot since Michael Jackson died last June. She sort of was in seclusion for a while, but I think she had some European dates planned, and I think she'll slowly start coming out and do a few more things. Few times I've seen her, she's been quite good.
Yeah, good. Well, thank you again.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye. Thank you.
I was reading about Berry Gordy and his rule for deciding to release a single. If you had a dollar, would you buy this record or a sandwich? It reminded me again of Henry Ford's dream of building a car for the masses or something.
Yeah. It was pretty, the competition was pretty tight for these records to come out.
Yeah. Why was that?
Well,
because he limited how many girl groups could.
No, not so much that. Okay. He just, it was a quality control issue.
Yeah,
he
definitely.
It was his way of getting really good work out of people to kind of pit them against each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way the industry operates still?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, I don't know of any, actually. I think it's actually kind of the other way around. It's pretty dismal right now what's out there in terms of pop music.
Yeah, I mean, they try to, but the quality is nothing. In that era.
And what's so great about a show like Dreamgirls is that you guys can sing, and it's so frustrating to see like a Taylor Swift out there.
Oh, you're a Taylor Swift detractor. Okay.
She just did a Kanye.
In the old days, that would never fly because she would be out there performing live and people would boo her off the stage and it would be done.
Right. And if you think about it, too, the technology wasn't what it is today.
Well,
I mean, there's
no.
So many more ways to manipulate. Well, we may, you know, we. We. Yeah. Anyways, you may rely on it more, but still, it's amazing the quality that came out of that generation.
Right.
Well, for instance, the myth that Diana can't sing, now that's based a little bit in reality. In terms of her voice was thinner than others. It was more teenage. And one of the Funk Brothers actually said to me point blank, Diana Ross could not sing. But those guys were tough. They were used to listening to Sarah Vaughan. You know?
Right.
Right.
That was their standard. The standard was so high back then.
Yeah.
Now today, if those guys, if he was alive and heard Taylor Swift, he'd be in outer space.
I guess the question is, will Taylor Swift endure the ages?
Oh, no. Come on.
I was being rhetorical.
Not even a
At least she writes her own stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's teenage stuff, though.
Yeah.
It's not stuff that other people are going to want to cover.
Everything seems teenage stuff.
Yeah.
Ironically.
Yeah, there's teenage and there's teenage. I mean, I would rather listen. I think... Please, Mr. Postman, will last longer.
Got you there. Yes, she. I'll have to agree with her on that.
We have
old school versus the new school. I love that. This is a whole nother show in itself.
No, old school's always going to win.
Oh, well.
You're very respectful. Thank you very much. We have to call it end to the show. However, thank you so much for being with me, Chester Gregory and Adrienne Warren from the Dreamgirls.
Thank you for having
us.
I
appreciate it. I know how hard you're working out there. And Susan Whitehall from the Detroit News, music critic and author of The Women of Motown. Thank you. Glad I didn't remember.
Thank you,
Susan, for being with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.